Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloem. Most folks love animals, from our pets and farm animals that we care for or the wildlife we like to watch. The creatures of the earth can be both a source of delight and sometimes dread. We fear large predators like mountain lions, wolves, and bears, with good reason. They can be dangerous if encountered in an unfortunate way. But we too are animals and have been part of the animal kingdom since the very dawn of humanity. Millennia ago, humans began domesticating animals. Our modern dogs are, after all, descended from wolves. And most cat owners will tell you that there's still a wild creature lurking in the minds of the friend they allow to sit on their lap. Far back in time, humans had reverence for the wild creatures that they hunted and the predators they sought to avoid. But as we humans became civilized, the notion began that we're not a part of the animal world, but somehow at the very top of creation or the evolutionary ladder. If you eat meat, you're eating an animal, and unless you hunted or caught that meat yourself, you're likely completely divorced from that process. It's just a package that you pick up at the meat section in your grocery store. But how have animals shaped who we really are and how we view ourselves and the world we live in? It's a question that has been part of the human experience for as long as we've walked the earth. Joining us to talk about how animals have influenced us and how we've affected them is Michael Bond. Michael is an author who specializes in human psychology, and in his new book, Animate, How Animals Shape the Human Mind, he attempts to unravel how intertwined we are with the species who don't have the ability to tell us how they think and feel, though we often sense those things, or at least think we can. The British writer joins us now from his home in England. Michael Bond, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Well, you wrote a previous book I'd like to learn a little bit about before we get into this one, about finding your way, which I thought was an interesting topic. Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, that is, it's about the psychology of navigation, I guess, and our relationship with our physical environment. Finding your way is something that's, well, humans have, through our evolutionary history, been pretty good at. We've had to be. Lately, perhaps not so much because we have some decent technology to help us, but the book was really looking at how our sort of modern ways have affected the way we interact with the world as much as find our way through it.
I always find it fascinating, you know, reading about people who get lost, because that's the opposite of finding your way. And I've noticed lots of times when I'm in the outdoors with people, there's a skill to being in the outdoors that really is something that's just very simple. It's just being deliberate and observant. Mm-hmm. And taking note of everything that you see and the relationships between, you know, where things are. So, like, for example, I do a lot of fly fishing in the mountains on mountain streams. And so, like, I like to figure out, you know, where I think the trout are going to be. And I always like to come back to certain places. So I'm always like looking, it's like that, oh, that tree there next to that rock, and kind of make this mental picture of where that is. And oh, okay, that's where I'm going to go down into the stream and find my way back out and things like that. And I notice there's a lot of people that just aren't that observant. And I think they're the ones that tend to get lost.
Yeah, people who aren't that observant, and also people who get fearful in those situations, maybe who are less confident in the wilderness, because that emotion really interferes with spatial memory, our ability to remember the landscape and to remember where we've been and to figure out where we're going.
Yeah, interesting. Well, let's talk about this book. What made you want to write about our relationship with animals and animal consciousness?
Well, I guess I've always grown up close to animals, being fascinated by them, spending a lot of time outdoors, but, you know, all of that. But my main motivation for this book was really the other direction, was human psychology and how it's more the way we see the world and our sort of existential insecurities that have shaped our relationship with animals, rather than, you know, what we've what we know about them or what we've observed about them. So I was just interested in how that sort of existential psychology has shaped our relationship with other animals. And it, so the book is comes from that very, very human perspective, less so simply about the animal science. It's really the human psychology that inspired me.
Yes, and it's very interesting. And it kind of goes back to what we were talking about before with people getting lost or not. There are people who have this comfort at level with animals. And, you know, you see that all the time. People that are highly skilled, like horse trainers that are, you know, horse whisperers and things like that. And people who are very comfortable around different animals. And then you see people who are frightened around animals. And in this, I've always found that interesting that some people are just not comfortable at all around animals. They get scared of, you know, things that to me would be like, oh, look at that. Isn't that beautiful? And people just have a different kind of reaction. So that's interesting.
Yeah. I guess that there's a sort of unknowable quality in some ways about animals. Or, I mean, for years, and scientists were as guilty of this as anyone, there's this assumption that, you know, animals, because they couldn't share with us what they feel, what they see, how they think, then we have to assume that they don't think like us, they don't feel like us. That has changed quite dramatically in the last 20 years in science. But for the last, you know, 2,000 years, there's been this idea that there's a sort of separation, a gulf between humans and the rest of the natural world. And I think people often, you know, once they entered adulthood, they are sort of exposed to this norm that animals are unknowable and that they you know, should be feared.
One of the things I loved about this book was the way it begins. I've always been interested in the ancient prehistoric cave paintings in Europe, you know, Lascaux, places like that. And you do a really interesting job of going into some of these places and explaining them. Tell us about some of your experiences there, because, you know, we're going back to the very roots of, you know, humanity there. And what do those paintings have to say to us about our relationship with animals back in the beginning?
It's a really extraordinary experience. You go into these caves. The paintings are, you know, 30,000 plus years old. The first thing is just astonishing to be in the presence of something that was created by humans so long ago, that are so ancient. And you immediately start thinking about what were those people like, and how similar or different were they to us? Then you look carefully at the paintings, and the paintings are like something that, you know, I feel we could have painted today, or could have been painted today in some ways. I'm thinking about just the level of skill that was involved, the sophisticated use of color, the detail that the artists recorded about the animals. And I guess the first real impression about the paintings themselves is just how sort of honest the depictions are. Animals are not shown sort of separate, as a separate thing. They're shown with kind of reverence, some kind of awe. I mean, they're just beautiful objects of art, these paintings on the walls, and they've been preserved incredibly well. That's what's so stunning. Often these caves, they're discovered by people quite randomly over the last 100 years, and they've been sealed for tens of thousands of years prior to that by natural processes, a landslide or whatever. So these paintings have been immaculately preserved in some cases. So there's all the, it's very hard to sort of properly describe them, because the experience is just so extraordinary. There's so many questions. You're thinking about the paintings, but you're also thinking about the people who painted them. There are so many questions which you can never be answered.
And in that sense, one of the things, my takeaway from that section of the book, which I thought was really interesting and what really well written, because you do convey that it's impossible to, you know, show somebody pictures of these paintings in a book and experience it like anything like it is to be there in that environment, in those dark caves, mm-hmm. you know, with flickering torchlight or whatever.
Right.
But what I thought was really cool about that, too, is it's like we can't really know what those artists were like.
No.
Just like we can't really know what, like, you know, what animals are actually thinking.
I mean, I guess we know some things. It's certain that we shared a similar brain, but the human brain has not changed very much in the last 40,000 years. So cognitively, probably a lot of similarities. Culturally, very different, because their way of living, their way of interacting with the world was substantially different. They were living among wild animals. They were both prey and predator. They had to survive in a very different world to ours. And yet they painted the animals that they saw with great sort of reverence and understanding, and they clearly knew about the animals, were very knowledgeable about the animals. You can tell that just by looking at the kind of detail that they included. So we know some things about them. You know, they were people like us, but their actual living environment was very different. Their culture was different. And we can never really know why they painted these paintings. That's the question that, you know, all archaeologists try to answer, but have trouble doing so.
What I found myself thinking about a lot after reading that section was the motivation to go into those very dark caves and put all that effort into creating that art, because it was, you know, that could not have been easy to do.
For sure. And in some cases, they would have had to crawl into small spaces and paint them on their back, lying on their backs, on the ceilings, and very often the paintings in the caves were far into the caves, and they weren't just sort of on the outside. They weren't necessarily for everybody else to see. One interesting thing about these paintings is that they are almost entirely of animals. There are very few human figures in that ancient, among the ancient cave art. And the human figures that they did depict are often sort of half animal, half human, hybrids, shapeshifters, or humans in some strange and magical scene with animals. So again, that's the question, why so few humans? I mean, you know, they were clearly fascinated primarily by animals.
What my mind went to when I saw those figures that are human animal-like forms was, it may also be something, you know, as simple as when you hunt, you know, animals, you usually use the skins of animals and dress up as them to, you know, as camo. It's, you mm-hmm. know, that was camouflage. So some of that may have been depicting, you know, hunters' ancient camouflage. I don't know, but it just, that thought occurred to me.
Well, that is one of the theories entertained by archaeologists, certainly. Hard to know.
But there, as you point out in later parts of the book, there's also this very strange aspect of human psychology of somehow wanting to sometimes cross over to being in the animal world as a human that's not really a human, but an animal now.
I think that's pretty common even today. I think people, we have a fairly complex, contradictory relationship with animals. Some tend to think of them as inferior, as something other than us, and yet, you know, we are fascinated by them, and they have played a crucial role in our culture and art, and they're present in our psychology, in our dreams. So there's this very, very complex relationship that we have even today. But as you say, people remain, I think, fascinated by animals, and what they're thinking and behaving.
And before we leave our ancient ancestors behind, there's one in particular that I found really interesting was the sculpture, because I'd never heard of sculpture before. I'd heard of the cave paintings, but could you tell us about the sculpture and the person that we think created those?
Actually, there are quite a few. I didn't write about them so much because I didn't actually see most of them, but in a few of the caves, there are what are clearly rock formations that have been sculpted into the shapes of animals. And there's one, I think it's a bear that's been left as if on an altar in a sort of large space in a cave. But there are also sculptures that have been found in Germany, figures shaped into animals. Often they are hybrid animal-human figures from that ancient time. So it wasn't just painting. It was across the artistic spectrum. And I mean, the only other area of ancient culture that informs us about relationship with animals is burials, human burials. People were often buried in the prehistoric times with animals or parts of animals in their graves. And, you know, that's also mysterious.
There's also a really cool image in your book of, maybe you could tell us about that, of what we think one of those sculptresses might have looked like.
Oh, yeah. This is an artist who sculpted these wonderful and huge horses in actually unusually on the outside of a rock formation, so facing out into a valley. And archaeologists discovered the skeleton of what they think might be the artist, a young woman who was buried at the foot of this frieze, and they figured out that she was left-handed, and whoever sculpted these figures was left-handed, and they can tell that because of the way the rock was worked. So that's an intriguing theory, and they've sort of put together a visual idea of what she might have looked like, which sort of brings the whole thing a step closer.
Yeah, it's kind of, it's beautiful and eerie to look at that image and think that may be one of the first human artists, and we're looking at her. Very, very interesting. I think, you know, the main takeaway for me, and I think most readers, is when you take us to those caves and back in time so far, you're taking us to a time when humans were deeply connected to nature and the world of animals.
Right.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. When we return, we'll continue our look at how humanity has been shaped by the animal kingdom over time with author Michael Bond as we discuss his new book, Animate, How Animals Shape the Human Mind. I'm Dave Shlohm, and you are listening to Blue Dot. Hey there, good listener. Dave Shlohm here, and I want to thank you for listening to the podcast version of Blue Dot. Without the support of our listeners, this show would not be possible. So if you enjoy the content we provide, I hope you'll take a moment and make a donation to the NPR member station that produces it, North State Public Radio. You can make a donation at our website, mynspr.org. And now let's get back to the show. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. Let's return now to our discussion of how humans and animals have been psychologically intertwined from prehistory to our modern world with Michael Bond, author of the new book, Animate, How Animals Shape the Human Mind. You get to something you call the Great Divide. That really is the central, I think, theme of the book, is that point where we have this break. Could you talk about that a bit?
Yeah. So I guess it was around 8,000 years ago. So this is the Neolithic period when humans were beginning to transition from the hunter-gatherer culture to a more settled existence, building villages, settlements, different form of government, and the art began to change at that time. There was a Neolithic settlement in Turkey called Çatalhöyük. They found a large mural of a red stag, a red deer stag, and it was surrounded by human figures who appear to be taunting the stag, poking at it at its nose or jumping on its back. And clearly this is depicting a very different kind of relationship between humans and animals that we were used to in the art of the previous era in the Ice Age, use and provocation, if you like. And then that theme continues throughout the art and culture of the Neolithic and right into the subsequent cultures, into ancient Greek and Rome. You can see how animals were used in artworks as objects, in a way, and that sort of relationship of awe and reverence, or just a different form of understanding has really gone. And it started in the early Neolithic, and that was really the start of what seems to be a very different kind of relationship between humans and people. I mean, and this was the era of domestication, when animals started to be actually domesticated and used by people in their settlements. That it's thought that that's when the change happened.
Going right along with that, and it is, especially when you read back in ancient times from, you know, the ancient philosophers from Greek times, the notion that develops and becomes embedded in Western civilization, that humans are this pinnacle of creation, that, you know, the top of the evolutionary ladder, however you want to look at it, that we are the tops and everything else is neat and great, but not as good as we are. And that's a dangerous notion for a species to live with, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree, but I think it probably arose out of a need. And when people started to settle and we had a different relationship with the natural world, we then had this need to understand our place in nature. You know, why am I here? What is the purpose of this?
Yes.
Yeah, what's the purpose of this? And, you know, what is the place of humans in the world? And we've been trying to answer those questions for a long time. But one way that we try to answer that is to put ourselves above, as you were saying, to make ourselves superior to the rest of nature, and to identify the characteristics, our sort of cognitive characteristics, our intelligence, rational thinking, morality, spirituality, all of that. We focused on that as a thing that gives us meaning above or separate to the rest of the animal world. And, you know, the question is, has that satisfied our existential need, our need to understand our place in nature? But perhaps it has, but it's had some severe consequences, obviously, for the animal world.
And it's also created over time, especially now, I think, in modern times, a real separation of humans from the natural world. And it feels to me like the more separated a person is from that, from nature, the more problems come along with that, psychologically and otherwise.
Yeah, possibly. It's a really hard one to answer. I mean, connectivity with nature does seem to have a very positive effect for a lot of people. But then, you know, you talk to people who have no connection and are doing fine. I mean, there are lots and lots of studies, of course, from people who live in cities and having mere sight of a green space changes all kinds of things for the better. But apart from anything else, you know, that idea that humans are separate from and superior to other species has been proved to be incorrect and an illusion, really, because modern science has shown us that animals share an awful lot more with us than we previously believed. And to some extent, it's based on a sort of false understanding of the natural world.
One of my favorite things in the writings of Carl Sagan, in one of his books, he writes about what he calls the great demotions. That we had put ourselves, at that the center of the universe, and we are the top, we are it, we are number one. And that, the Earth is not the center of the universe. It's not the center of the solar system. And the sun's not even the center of the universe. So, demotion.
Yeah.
And then to our modern understanding of, where humans are, truly in the grand scheme of nature that we're part of, and we are special. We have these special attributes, but not necessarily in some kind of pinnacle position. It's interesting.
Yeah, I think that it's a good time to try and rework our relationship with the natural world, given what we now know about how, we are not as central or superior as we thought we were, and what we also now know about the abilities and attributes of other animals. I mean, we think of ourselves as highly intelligent, as the most intelligent species, but how intelligent have we been in the way we treat the natural world? And we're not that good at sorting out conflict between different human outgroups, apart from anything else. That's something that we need to figure out. And I think the idea of us living on some sort of pinnacle of intelligence is, hard to really reinforce.
And I think it's dangerous. It just any time you lack humility in any way, shape, or form, you're setting yourself up for trouble.
For sure.
It's just my take on things. Okay, let's go back in time a little more, because I also have always found this interesting. Back like in medieval times, and the interesting drawings and stories about strange beasts, mythical creatures. Well, we think of them that way now. Manticores and, the god Pan, for example. Things like that, where they're like half beast, half human. Mermaids, all kinds of stuff like that. What is your take on that? Where do you think that all came from? What's the meaning of all that?
I think that, and we've been talking about this idea, predominantly Western idea, of there being a separation between humans and animals, and imagining animals not to share the essential attributes of humans. But people, as we said before, have always been fascinated by animals, and I think perhaps haven't always bought into that sort of establishment line. And one area where we've been always free to explore the relationship between animals and humans and the possible existence of mythical beasts is art and literature and mythology and fairy tales and fables, all full of these sort of stories where the possible attributes and strange behaviors of animals and humans are explored. So, I mean, even in Britain, you go into any medieval church or cathedral, and you can find these strange creatures carved into some of the most sacrosanct areas of these buildings, into the choir stalls, for example. So clearly people were exploring these themes, even in medieval times, alongside theologians and philosophers, and maintaining that we were profoundly different.
Do we have any idea of what the meaning of that is? Why they would place those in a place like a cathedral? What was the purpose of it, I wonder?
It's hard to say. I mean, it's possible that the people who actually carved them were the people who were really closer to animals, and they sort of smuggled them in. At the same time, in a lot of the books of beasts that were very popular in medieval times, they were religious texts, and they used animals, depicted animals as a way of portraying human morality. And in a way, they were sort of using animals to exhibit the right behaviors of humans. But I think, you know, people were still fascinated by them and by the idea that these animals might exist in the sort of far off stretches of the world that hadn't been explored. Those sort of notions of terrifying or extraordinary animals with sort of misshapen limbs and bizarre magical abilities, they were very widely believed in all levels of Western society during medieval times. So I think it's another illustration of just our complex relationship with other species, and it's been like that all the way.
Yeah, and you write beautifully. You have terrific command of the English language, which you touch on in the book too. That, you know, this notion that we have language, and you know, to me, we have language and the opposing thumb and forefinger. Those two things together definitely separate us in a way and allow us to make things and communicate with each other. But you touch on the fact that we don't really understand when we listen to other languages being spoken by animals, bird song, whale song, things like that. We don't really understand those, what the meaning of them is.
For sure. And over the last 20 years, we've learned a lot more about how different species communicate, about the complexity of their vocalizations, different species of birds. I mean, bird song used to be viewed as something, you know, that was a little monosyllabic in a way, in its meaning. But now it's understood that there are all kinds of different levels in which birds communicate. The area that where this has received most attention is with whales and dolphins, of course. And there's a great project, SETI, which is trying to unpack the complex patterns of communications in humpback whales and dolphins. And clearly, we've vastly underestimated the complexity of their communication. Yes. You know, it's interesting. You sort of think, well, where is this going to end? This sort of investigation. What are we going to discover about what they are saying to each other? What happens if we're able to communicate with them? You know, what would they say to us? It's sort of mind-boggling.
It could be rather depressing, as you point out. Yeah, well, that's interesting. And I wanted to mention something that made me smile in your book. You mention a recording, Songs of the Humpback Whale by Roger Payne, was very popular back in the late 1960s, I think. And you said how that album was so influential. And you're right. And when I was a kid, I probably listened to that album at our beach house in Malibu more than the Beatles.
Oh wow!
I loved listening to the whale songs, because then I would go out on my surfboard and paddle out, and there would be California gray whales would be swimming by me, and I would love to have, you know, imagine, you know, what are they saying to each other? What are they singing? When I read that, I had a big smile on my face. So, yep, I remember that record.
Yeah, well, I think Roger Payne, I believe he was a musician, and he sort of recognized the musical quality of those songs. Yeah, he called them songs. And music is something we find very easy to interact with and to be moved by. So, yeah, I'm not surprised in your reaction.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us as we continue our examination of how we interact with and are influenced by our fellow travelers in the animal kingdom with British author Michael Bond. His new book, Animate, How Animals Shape the Human Mind, is out now. I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. Dave Shlom here, and we'll get right back to the program. But before we do, I wanted to take a moment to thank you for listening and supporting this program. If you've never perused our archives, it's well worth a look at the myriad of topics we've covered in recent years. You can do that at mynspr.org, and while you're at it, consider making a donation to the public radio station that produces Blue Dot, North State Public Radio. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. We're speaking with British author Michael Bond. In his new book, Animate, How Animals Shape the Human Mind, Bond explores our complex and at times confounding relationships with other members of the animal kingdom. Another singular person from history that I've always found fascinating, you mentioned in your book, I'd like to hear what you think about St. Francis of Assisi. Because when you talk about animals and humans, it's like he stands out as a very singular figure to me.
Yeah. I mean, theologians have not had a great record in their sort of appreciation of other species, I would say. But St. Francis is very unusual in the Catholic Church in his reverence for other creatures. And a lot of the art that depicts St. Francis is always shown with, you know, with doves, other birds, and the famous wolf that he supposedly tamed. And I imagine that when he was around, he probably caused some consternation with among other theologians, because that sort of attitude of understanding the spirituality, perhaps, of other creatures was not a common one in the church.
Okay, you mentioned St. Francis and the wolf. You have a really interesting section in here that's very appropriate and poignant for us to talk about here in Northern California right now, wolves, and our relationship with them, because it certainly is a relationship fraught with hatred, fear, them being the ultimate other of the animals, I guess. You tell us about your trip to Canada and some of the interesting experiences you had up there, especially with one rancher in particular who had a kind of a different approach to wolves.
Yeah, so I was in Alberta, northern Alberta, and it's kind of on the northern frontier of the farming world up there. And they have a lot of conflict between farmers and wolves, and you know, most farmers would, you know, given a shot, would probably remove wolves from their area because they kill cattle, and that's a fact.
And up there, they're allowed to shoot them.
They are allowed to shoot them, absolutely, and they also are compensated for the death of cattle by wolves. So wolves are extraordinary survivors. You know, they've been hunted to near extinction and come back in almost every part of the world, particularly North America and Europe. The woman who I spent time with, she had a group of dogs, big dogs that she originally from Europe, from Eastern Europe, to protect her animals from the wolves and from bears. And she has taken that approach, and it's been very successful. The dogs, they basically sit out with the flocks, with the sheep, with the cattle, and guard them fiercely against any predators. So she's sort of sowing a different message. And when she first moved there, she found it quite difficult to be accepted because there's a lot of opposition. Wolves were always seen as something that our farmers can't live with. But since then, she's converted a lot of people to her ways. But I was just interested in the wolf in particular because it's so similar to humans in so many ways, in its society, the way it cares for its young, its success in adapting to different environments, and how humans have coped with that has been traumatic in some ways, but has also thrown up a lot of interesting insight in how we relate to predators.
And they really are a very cooperative apex predator. And you mentioned in there that they will a lot of times, you know, prey on animals in a way that I don't want to go into too deep a description here because it can be disturbing for folks. But it can, from our point of view, seem extremely cruel. Of course, from their point of view, they're just doing their wolf thing. So I don't like to attach words like cruel to things that nature does, but they're just, you know, that's part of it. But you can see why, you know, especially here in Northern California, we now have wolves in the area. We have ranchers that are extremely concerned. There was a recent study by the University of California at Davis that just came out showing, because they're studying the scat and stuff from the wolves, that most of their predation right now is on cattle. It's, you know, that's mostly what they're eating here. So they, you know, they are not accessing wild game as much as they are, you know, cattle. And that's creating a tremendous conflict here, and where these ranchers here cannot just shoot them. They're protected. But they sure, you know, I'm sure if you were to talk to ranchers, 9 out of 10 of them would say, if I was allowed to kill them, I would. And maybe they already have and wouldn't tell anybody and just buried the body or whatever. But I, you know, I can't blame them. That's a difficult way to make a living, cattle ranching, to begin with. You're right on the margins no matter what. And it takes a lot of time and investment, and those wolves are making life much more difficult for them.
Yeah. I mean, I was a real newbie coming into the subject of wolves. We don't have wolves in Britain. So I had, you know, had to come to North America to find out about that.
You also tell some really interesting stories about trackers and trappers, and them gaining the ultimate respect for these animals because they are not easy to trap. You tell some amazing stories about the difficulty of achieving that.
Yeah, I met a guy who, well, he spends his life trapping largely wolves in Alberta. And he, you know, he knows that animal better than anyone. And he says their intelligence is something that we have seriously underestimated, because if he missteps, if he breaks a trail, if he leaves his smell, his scent somewhere, anywhere near his trap, if he does something that he hasn't carefully thought about and considered, then that wolf is going to be out of there. And so whenever he catches a wolf, he knows that he has done a very good, careful job, because the wolves are always a step ahead of him. He finds that the wolves are following him, tracking him, while he thinks he's tracking them.
Yeah.
They seem to have an awareness of what the humans around them are doing. So this guy had a sort of profound respect for these animals. And if you read back in sort of stories of trackers through the ages in North America and Europe, you know, they have a similar sentiment to this guy I spoke to, this ultimate respect for the animal that they're tracking. And often they've spent months following one single animal, trying to trap them or shoot them, and, you know, failing because the wolf is a step ahead of them. So it's a sort of accepted understanding among trackers that wolves are often cleverer than the humans that are following them.
And it's quite, you know, well documented and well known that humans have had a long-term deep hatred and fear of wolves. You know, they're, you know, from the story of Little Red White Riding Hood, that you even go into that. But, you know, as you point out in the book, it's also that we almost all have doggies in our houses. And we love our dogs. Mm-hmm. That, you know, that when we go back in time to those people that were making the cave paintings, back in time, somewhere in there, wolves and humans decided, hey, let's do this stuff together. And from that, we have dogs.
Yeah, and it was very much likely to have been a two-way thing, a decision on both sides. I mean, it's thought somewhere between 26,000 and 19,000 years ago. And the most likely scenario is that a female wolf with pups had a den somewhere near a human encampment, and the humans started to feed the young wolves. And the young wolves would, you know, take the scraps of meat, and then the wolves would go hunting, and the humans would follow the hunt. And it became clear that, you know, there were advantages on both sides, and that's how the domestic dog slowly evolved into something that is in fact extremely very different to the wild wolf, but that evolutionary journey is pretty clear.
Yeah, it's just an amazing thing to think about, how we've had been at war with wolves for millennia and trying to extirpate them, and then they keep coming back, and yet that's where our dogs come from. They were originally wolves. It's just such an interesting thing to consider when you look at your best friend laying there on the floor next to you. It's like, yeah, your ancient ancestor was a little different.
Yeah. In some ways, I mean, we look at, assume our pet dogs are kind of know what we're thinking. We have that sort of relationship with them, and we treat them as human in up to a point. But with wolves, very different thing. But we I think we still treat them as partially human in a different way. We judge their behaviors mm-hmm. as moral. You know, we afford them human morality, and this idea that the way they kill their prey is cruel or evil, which you often hear those words in the farming communities in Alberta. So very different animals now, but they share a not dissimilar place in our relationship with the natural world.
So you have a dog and a cat in your home, correct?
Well, actually, yeah, I have a cat. My wife has a dog, but the situation at the moment is that my wife's dog doesn't like cats, will try to eat cats. He's a lovely dog in all other ways.
Sure.
So at the moment, they're not living together. So
my question for you is, and this has always been something that I thought's interesting, is there is the notion that there are dog people and there are cat people, and there's different just psychological profiles or whatever that go with that. What do you have to say about the whole dog and cat person debate?
Well, after speaking to a few psychologists about this, there seems to be some truth in the idea that dog people who love dogs are different to people who like cats. Obviously, that's sort of stating it in the extreme. But the studies have shown that dog people are perhaps more sociable, more agreeable. Cat people might be more neurotic, more insular.
More independent?
Possibly more independent, more worried. One psychologist described it this way. He said, dog people with dogs, they always know how their dog feels about them. Their dog always loves them. And that itself can give them some security. Cat people, well, you never know what your cat really thinks of you. So cat people are often trying to convince themselves that their cat loves them. And that might make them a little neurotic.
I read something very simple in your book that struck me as like, oh, I never thought about that. And it was that cats don't really meow much at each other. They meow at us mm-hmm. to get us to do stuff for them. But when they, you know, if they're going to talk to each other, it's more of that snarly stuff. It's not the cute meow. It's more the, you know, that stuff. So I was like, wow, I never thought about that. That was cool.
Yeah. I would obviously love to know what my cat is trying to tell me. although perhaps that would take away some of the joy and mystery of having a cat.
And a dog, you don't really know what they're thinking, but I think dogs, horses for sure, and cats, animals that live with humans are really good at sensing not what we think, but how we feel.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And it is all about feeling. And when our pet dies, the grief that you feel for your pet, it can be quite overwhelming and also confusing to people, because you often think, I shouldn't feel this way for a pet, for an animal. But then, you know, why not? Because the relationship with your pet animal can be extremely deep and intense and meaningful. And therefore, it's completely normal to feel grief when they pass on.
Something I can unfortunately relate to all too well. Well, it's been lovely to talk to you, Michael. And this is a really great book, fascinating read, Animate. And I want to thank you for joining us here on Blue Dot.
Thank you so much, Dave. I've really enjoyed this conversation.
Thanks again to our guest, British author Michael Bond. His new book, published by Pegasus, is titled Animate: How Animals Shape the Human Mind. It's available at most major booksellers or order it from your favorite local bookstore. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of Chico State Enterprises and licensed to California State University Chico in beautiful and talented Northern California. We're distributed by PRX. If you want to revisit, share, or check out past episodes, you can do just that on our website, mynspr.org. And while you're at it, subscribe to our podcast so you never miss an episode on our website, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music, Big Wave Dave, is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler, with help from Chico State student intern, Stefan Barger. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.